Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast, episode 116, the one about ageism in marketing, Adobe pluses and minuses in the film, An Officer and a Gentleman. Let's get on with the show.
Welcome everyone to another recording of Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast. We are back with more news, tech content and wisdom from the world of marketing. Joining me, my co-host, a marketing speaker and consultant who spent his whole career helping his customers keep their marketing simple but effective, is the author of Cat's Mouse and Marketing Plans and the creator of the Roger Log video series. I give you Mr. Roger Edwards.
No, thank you so much. And of course, my co-host is a digital marketing veteran. He's a speaker, trainer, and advisor with nearly three decades of experience. He enjoys revealing visual storytelling techniques to help you build better online campaigns faster. I give you Monsieur Pascal Fintoni.
Thank you very much, everyone. This is episode 116. Those numbers keep creeping up, and it's really quite special, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. You're sort of blinking. How did we get another 10 episodes in the bag? It's just nuts. Time just goes by so fast. I mean, as we've said a few times, we started doing this during the pandemic to keep us sane and to give people a little bit of relief and a little bit of marketing information. And 4 years have gone by, Pascal.
Oh, yes. It's a little crazy. But you know, we're very, very happy. Thank you, everyone, for the likes, the comments, and the shares. Sometime now, as I'm doing more and more in-person events, Roger, I bump into people saying, oh, I love your podcast. So please don't wait until you bump into Roger or I. Tell us before, you know, online, and please do send your suggestions that we mentioned time and time again. We're going to start with In the News, and this is actually quite a biggie. I'm going to struggle to pick my favorites this time. We're going to move on to the content spotlights and looking at the show notes. We'll be talking again, I believe, my favorite subject, public speaking, presentation design, but also, Roger, I want to explore this idea of ageism in our industry. We're going to move on to This Week in History, exploring what's happened back in the days in the 50s and 70s. We're going to also have, I think, a bit of a battle of the apps, a bit of a standoff, because you're going to be talking about perhaps moving on from Adobe. I'm going to recommend people to use more Adobe products. So that's going to be good fun. And we're going to finish with our favorite segment, of course, film marketing. And you chose the film.
I did choose the film, Pascal, and it's quite an old one now in reality. It's over 40 years old, but it's one of my favourite films of all time. And the ending of the film always, always makes me tear up. And it is Officer and a Gentleman, and one of Richard Gere's first films, an Oscar-winning performance by Louis Gossett Jr. And it's just an absolutely epic film, and I really can't wait for us to talk about it later.
Oh, likewise. I mean, I've got flashbacks of watching this film. It came out in 1982. I was very young then, but it stays with you, doesn't it, that film? But 82 was also a very competitive year. We'll discuss as well all the other titles that were out there asking for people's times and wallet, and how did this movie do back, you know, in the days. But let's begin with In the News.
YouTube has introduced a new policy requiring creators to disclose if their videos have been altered using AI, although it's unclear if this will affect the algorithm.
Well, talk about Google, who's now added a new section within its business listings in Search called Social Media Updates, which displays recent social media posts from your connected profiles.
In a survey, 2,000 UK and US participants were presented with two articles, one written by ChatGPT and one by a trained copywriter, and 50% correctly identified the AI-generated copy.
Well, Tech Republic interviewed UK industry experts who identified the three most significant trends in cybersecurity: AI-powered ransomware, zero-day exploits, and Internet of Things security breaches.
Gosh. The reach of traditional TV is shrinking, but it remains an important channel with high levels of trust, with 56% of the total time spent viewing TV dedicated to broadcast TV.
TikTok has taken the initiative to fight the sell-off bill proposed in the US with a new, listen to this, $2.1 million ad campaign, which aims to showcase the benefits that TikTok provides to US users.
Pepsi Max has unveiled its first major redesign in 14 years by displaying a 20-metre-high inflatable Pepsi Max can near the O2 in London. The reveal was followed by a light show of drones in the Docklands sky.
A nationwide advert featuring actor Dominic West has claimed the building society was not closing branches. It has been banned following an investigation by the Advertising Standards Authority. I'm going to start with that one. That's embarrassing, isn't it? When you put all that effort and money, and I mean, I love Dominic West as well as an actor, and this, you've seen the advert, I'm guessing. It's a great form of visual storytelling. But then you basically fall foul of the fact that you are closing branches whilst mocking other banks closing their branches. I'm guessing that the marketing team was never told that their employer was closing branches when they made this advert.
It sounds like it, but of course you're thinking, who is signing this stuff off? I mean, you know, we go on and on a lot on this show about the importance of strategy. And, you know, it's not just marketing strategy we're talking about here. This is business strategy. So if the overall nationwide had a business strategy to close branches, you would have thought that it would have been important for them to have kept an eye on what the marketing department were doing, especially if they were going to be doing some communication which effectively contradicted your business strategy. So everybody just ends up looking stupid and they've all got egg on their face.
Yeah, and that's an expensive mistake because I can only guess at the budget for this advert and the fees, you know, that Dominic West asked for. Yeah, and it's so typical of large organization, you know, where somehow the marketing advertising division is almost in a silo.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's staggering. But, you know, I've worked in financial services a lot, as you know, Pascal, and it sort of doesn't surprise me. This sort of thing happens because the industry is incredibly siloed. So you will have a marketing department working way over there, and your product people will be way over there, and your pricing people will be way over there in another direction. And quite often, the lines of communication between the elements just don't happen.
Yeah,
they don't marry. They don't marry up, and that's why these mistakes happen.
I want to ask you your reaction with the first news item you read out, which is YouTube new policy. So people will have to tick the box, or you know, find a way to disclose that their video has been altered using AI. What do you think about this?
This is interesting because this news item has almost changed since we wrote it down a few days ago. And I've watched quite a lot of videos about this already. And YouTube is saying it will not affect the algorithm unless, of course, you're doing something really bad, like impersonating a real person, like a politician, or you disseminating bad information. But if you're just using it to make a video look better or make the sound look better, it's absolutely fine. But I think that it is very, very important because people want to know whether they're dealing with real people. And yet, let's face it, AI is getting better and better at impersonating real people. And I think that it's good that YouTube are introducing this, so that it's almost like a watermark, isn't it? This is a real person, or this has been created by AI. And I think that that's probably a good thing. I imagine it has been prompted by this sort of darker side of things, where people have been using AI to impersonate other people, probably for criminal reasons. So they absolutely have to do it. And all the videos and all the analysis I've seen so far seem to me that it's not going to affect creators like myself, for example. Now, I don't really use AI other than maybe to make the sound a little bit better. But I think that as long as you are on the level, you're going to be unaffected by this, I think.
Yeah, and then you've got the very obvious AI productions, you know, what they call now faceless videos, where the script was done by AI, the animation, which sometimes looks impressive, I would say, almost like a mini documentary using 2D or 3D art and so on. From an educational point of view, I can see that working. So there's the very obvious one. But yeah, the if you alter, for example, you know, you have an old video from your CEO making the announcement of something, you know, in 2017, and then you want to use AI to say, for the CEO to say something very different that he signed off or she signed off, and you know this idea of yeah, this was done via AI. So let's then link that with this experiment of 2,000 UK-US participants, whereby two articles, one written by ChatGPT AI, one by a trained copywriter, and 50% correctly identify the AI-generated copy. I suppose deep down, I wish that figure was a bit higher, but, you know, we are where we are, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend the entire show talking about this one particular news item. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and it goes quite deep. I've heard people saying that ChatGPT and the equivalents, Gemini and Microsoft Copilot, are actually getting worse rather than better.
Oh.
At putting out content. And I've heard quite a few people say, do you know what? It's just not putting out as good stuff. It's so much more noticeable that it's being generated by AI. But when you think about it, we've said right from the start that if your prompts or your briefs, as we've said a few times, if your briefs to these AI platforms are rubbish, you're going to get rubbish out. If you brief mediocrity, you're going to get mediocrity out. And I just wonder whether a lot of people have just not heeded that advice and they are just basically getting mediocre content. But of course, what ChatGPT and all of these other AI platforms do is they scrape the entirety of the internet, don't they? So if we are piling more mediocre content in, then isn't it obvious that it's going to start giving us more mediocre content because it's scraping more mediocre content? So actually, even though the technology is probably getting better in terms of how it can create outputs, it's all the inputs that we're giving it which are creating some of this mediocre output. So it's possible that that figure will increase if that's the trajectory we're on.
Yeah, and I think for me, my point is very clear. When I do the workshops on AI, its contribution to innovative thinking, creative thinking, is negligible because it's repeating. You know, I think I've used the term artificial imitation on the show before. It's repeating what's out there, and it's just a kind of strange gormenghast of everybody's ideas, which is therefore very mediocre and average. Very, very quickly for our viewers and listeners, so I read out the news about the Google Business Profile with the social media update. So go and do that. And it'd be good for you to have your Instagram, LinkedIn, or X post featured, you know, on there. And talk to your IT companies about the three major threats, you know, AI-powered ransomware, the 0 days exploit, that is to say, don't delay to update your system because people are going to get in the day of the update. And for me, it's always been a big, big concern, you know, and I wanted to get your views on that. The Internet of Things, you know, people are buying more and more kits for the home, but this is the number one way for baddies to get into your computers, into your banking and so on. So, you know, do be careful about all this. But let's move on with TikTok. So, as people will be aware of, they've been given two options. You leave the US completely, or you sell your US arm to somebody else. And they're fighting, obviously, you know, that looming decision. This is a big, big campaign, 2.1 million ad campaign. And what they're doing, Roger, they're using TikTok users and particularly traders who are saying, you're taking away from me my online store. You know, you're going to kill my business if this bill goes ahead. I mean, do you have a sense of where this is going to go?
I have no idea. I mean, to a certain extent, there's an element of TikTok has been demonized, hasn't it? Especially in America. And obviously, they're perceiving there to be a threat from China here. Whether that's true or not, who will know? But it does feel to me that TikTok has become a bit of a scapegoat. And I'm sure that when you dig beneath the surface of all these social media channels, there will be potential harm happening in all of them. I mean, crikey, X or Twitter, I just can't get my head around calling it X. Twitter has become a bit of a cesspit, to be perfectly honest. And there's a lot of horrible, horrible right-wing, extreme right-wing views within Twitter. So why aren't we suggesting banning that? I just think that TikTok has become a bit of a scapegoat. Having said that, I also picked up a piece of news yesterday from the UK that the government are considering banning children under the age of 16 from having mobile smartphones.
Correct.
So, you know, again, is that because by having a phone, you've got access to TikTok and they feel that things like TikTok and X and all these others have a bad effect on the mental health of youngsters? Or is it the fact that these social media platforms need to up their game themselves rather than having the platforms upon which they work being banned in their entirety?
Yeah, and I think for me, business management and strategy point of view, this is where people have got to really take the advice that's been shared for some years now, Roger. You know, you and I've shared it, this idea of be careful about building a business on rented land. Because decisions such as this one could happen, or it could be simply, as has happened on Facebook, oh, we don't fancy doing Facebook shops anymore, and we're going to kill them overnight. And there's only those who were trading using the Facebook shops feature, which was launched during the pandemic, out of, you know, communication channels. So just be pragmatic and see if you can spread, you know, your activities across another platform. Let's finish on a bit of a hi then. Pepsi Max, are you a drinker? Isn't it annoying that all the good stuff happens in London?
I think that's going to have to be the focus of that little discussion. Yeah, very rarely does anything big happen outside London. You know, we forget that we've got Birmingham and Manchester and Newcastle and Edinburgh and Glasgow. I've not had a can of any form of Coke, whether it's Coca-Cola Coke or Pepsi Coke or Pepsi Max Coke, for over 10 years. I took a decision as we returned from a holiday in Mallorca that I just had spent my entire life drinking far too much Coke of various types, and therefore I've not had a sip, not one sip, in over 10 years. So I honestly just couldn't tell you what Pepsi Max tastes like anymore.
Yeah. If I want to have a treat, oddly, I go for Dr. Pepper myself. Mm-hmm. But I do, you know the difference in Coke and that kind of thing. But yeah, so for me, you know, I mean, you and I like to report those kind of PR stunts because it can be a source of ideas for viewers and listeners. I mean, not to the scale of a 20-meter high inflatable can. But yeah, I'm frustrated sometimes because a vast majority of what is being reported and what you and I can share is always in London, and it wouldn't be hard to have a tour of the UK with that PR stunt, would it?
Not at all. Having said that, it's interesting. I was just mentioning the financial services industry there, and as you know, I do the marketing for a very big financial services conference that happens in London every year at the fabulous Landmark Hotel. And, you know, a lot of people said, why don't you do a regional version of this? And it has been tried in the past by a lot of firms. And if you do put on a show in Manchester or Newcastle or Birmingham or something like that, the turnout is usually pretty low. So a lot of people say, well, people say we should do things outside London, but when we do things outside London, nobody comes to them. So guess what? We go back to London.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Listen, always a pleasure to scan through the news that you know spotted and selected. But let's slow things down and go for a deep dive discussion with our next segment, the Content Spotlights. Now, in this part of the show, Roger and I select a piece of content that can help us have a great conversation about what it means to be a marketer in today's economy. So what is your selection?
Well, this is quite a simple article this week, Pascal. Nothing too detailed, but I just loved it for its simplicity. Like you, I've been invited to do a few talks at a few conferences coming up over the next 6 months to 9 months. And as always, I just like to just keep up to date and refresh my speeches and just look at techniques and this, that, and the other. And I came across this one, and I almost think it's going to be a sort of go-to for getting ideas for how to structure your own speech or presentation. So the article is called How to Structure a Speech or Presentation. It's by Nick Morgan, and it's on a website called Public Words. And it's not what you're going to expect, in that normally people would go on about that, well, you've got to think about the subject matter, you've got to approach the organizer of the conference and make sure that it fits. Now, this is once you've done all of that, once you know what you're going to do, it's just using quite identifiable and techniques that you will know, just to prompt you. So we're starting off with one of my favorite ever structures for any form of communication, and it's the basic problem solution structure. Now, you might have heard this referred to as problem agitate solution or something like that. So you say to somebody, you know, you've got dry, dank looking hair, and that makes you look really rough in the morning, or it makes you look untidy if you go out to a meeting or something like that. So our new Ceramide R super shampoo will make your hair glow, and you'll look absolutely radiant as you stand up and talk to your business colleagues. That's the problem agitate solution format. And again, here he's saying this is just one of the best ways to do a presentation. Give people the basic problem, but then you agitate it, you make it relevant to them, you give them the consequences of what that problem is and why it affects you, and then you just give them the solution. And it's just fabulously simple. But how many presentations have you been to, Pascal, where they go in and out, they go over here on a tangent, they go over there on a tangent, they add in supplementary stories, and you completely lose track of what people are saying? And yeah, if you follow that problem agitate solution structure, you can nail something in a few minutes. It can be really good. But the structure also works for much longer presentations, but as long as you stick to it rather than going off on a load of tangents. And effectively, the rest of the article is giving us little structures like that. So the first one, problem agitate solution, we've got at least 15 here. So there's the cause to effect structure. So this approach is particularly good when you have a positive vision of the future. If we plant trees now, in 20 years we'll have a forest. Or it's opposite: if we fail to act today, our grandchildren will be living in a hellscape. So again, the cause to effect structure, you can just imagine how simple that is, just to paint your narrative around it. The definition structure: the idea here is to define some aspects of the future as similar to the past, and as such either to be avoided or sought out. We've seen this approach before. It's just like what our ancestors did, and they lost the continent. Let's not see as make that mistake again. I'm not going to read all of these out, Pascal, but there's the classification structure. There's the appealing to authority structure. I like this one. This is the expert's way in here. You might begin by sampling several or championing one. Jane Smith, the world's reigning expert in the existence of parallel universes, argues that the awareness of one doesn't imply that others don't exist. So, you know, you can tap into an expert and bounce off some of the things that they're saying. Another one, weighing probabilities. Another one, using inductive reasoning and employing comparative advantages. So what I would suggest is, as I say, I don't want to read these out because I'll ruin the surprise, but this article will literally take you no more than 10 minutes to scan it. But if you then sit down and go through each of these, starting with problem agitate solution, working your way all the way down to using a simple chronology: in the beginning God created the heaven and earth, etc., etc., or once upon a time, and then see how you could do your latest presentation or your latest speech in the style of that. And it's remarkable how many ideas it gives you, and how it might just prompt you to alter it slightly so that it appeals to your audience a lot more.
This is so good. And you know, by extension, this will also give you perhaps what you need. I mean, recently I've had some conversation with clients where they find the whole business of content creation, you know, blogging, sometimes websites, social media, where they go, it's been years and I'm running out of steam here. I'm running out of ideas. And sometimes saying, well, maybe you need to change your storytelling. And then they look at you blankly. And I totally agree. The term storytelling is so enigmatic. It's meaningless. But I think this is what we mean. We mean that have a structure that's going to stimulate your imagination and make sure that you tell, you know, share the information in a way that is comprehensive. I like that a lot. Thank you very much, Roger.
It's interesting, actually, you said that. I wonder whether sometimes by using the term storytelling, and I use it all the time, it's one of my favourite subjects, and we've talked about it on the show so much, but I wonder whether the term storytelling does put people off. And if you would say to them, use the problem agitate solution model, instead of saying storytelling, because it is a storytelling framework. Problem agitate solution, it's just a different way of doing it. It's the same as the three act structure in a film, isn't it? You know, you've got your introduction, you've got your conflict, and you've got your resolution. It's the same sort of thing. But if you say to somebody, do storytelling, it sets all sorts of alarm bells off. But if you say to somebody, do the three act structure, it might be an easier way of explaining to them what you want them to do.
Yes, because very briefly, the reaction I get is storytelling. For some, it takes them back to school where they used to be basically shamed by the teacher for not writing well or for this and the other. And, or yeah, this idea, well, I'm not a marketer, I'm not a content creator, and you know, people will have that modesty. And I think systems and structures are there to support you. But I think, you know, more importantly, I can also say that they won't tie you down. They're going to really, really stimulate your imagination. So go and have a look. We have the hyperlinks in the show notes for all of you. So I chose an article as well, and a very brief one. But when I was looking for something for episode 116, I was looking for something that would be educational, something that would allow me to, you know, share my views on the wonders of marketing and selling. But this is actually very, very different. It's been a while since I've either read or selected an article which is more of a personal story, opinion, insight, and the title is as follows: I was an old agency dog, but I learned new tricks. And that's from John Ashwell, who's creative director currently at George P. Johnson Creative Agency. And this was written for the Drum, and it feels almost like a blog post or a letter that could have been written to somebody in not a public address. But this is actually, I was commonly drawn into it, and you would read, all of you, this open letter, I would argue, as opposed to an article, within 5 minutes, but it's going to stay with you. And John doesn't mess about. The first few words are as follow. Diamond and the Drum is obviously representing the creative and marketing agency. Our industry has a problem with ageism. And it tells a story that 7 years ago, John Ashwell lost his job because he was deemed to be too old to be creative. And then the story goes into how that was actually, you know, door closes and new doors open. But, you know, so there's a structure about, you know, what has happened to him. Then the reflection on, well, a new challenge and new skills. And then the conclusion, which is the one, age should not be a barrier. But you need to have, of course, enlightened, open-minded employers or clients for that matter. Now, there's something I didn't know at all. And I'm going to be careful, you know, that the whole premise of this article is actually to encourage all of you, no matter the age, to understand that you learn all the time. And your article actually, you know, present that point. But in terms of our industry, so at the time of writing the article, or at the time of losing his job, John was 55. And so it happened he was part of the 7% of over 50s in the marketing creative industry. And that shocked me, only because I'm 55 in October.
Yeah.
And he kind of says, you know, this is tiny, tiny compared to other industries where typically it's 25-30% of the workforce on average is over 50 plus, because this is about wisdom and experience and so on. So the whole article then kind of goes, right, so it was a shock. It was very unpleasant. But, you know, ultimately there was two events. One, an employer that understood that creative thinking is not linked to age. You could argue that it's by experience and the highs and lows and trial, you know, the kind of, as I call it sometimes, the scales and the badges, but also that, you know, new technology is new to all of us. Even, you know, and I think that there is a default position in many industries where, particularly when you talk about the push marketing of social media, email and SEO, that it's a young person's game. What it was 30 years ago, because I, you know, 30 years ago I was in my 20s, but I would say 30 years experience in SEO is going to be more valuable than 30 days, you know, but of course I'm going to defend our age group. So I would people should read that, because it's basically a invitation to embrace change, to embrace new technologies, and to understand that all of us are learning, and the advantage of seniority is just that, because you can come up with more common sense, more pragmatic approach. What I will say, not stealing the thunder and the surprise like you of the article, I will read out just, you know, the final paragraph, which is as follows. So if you're thinking that you're past your sell-by date, forget it. Losing my previous job was a good thing. It was probably just an excuse to offload the old bloke, but it helped me find a fresh outlet for my creative thinking. It taught me to embrace the new. And that, with the right people around you, you can be creative for as long as you like.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom here, Pascal. And, you know, my philosophy has always been every day is a school day, you know, learning every day. I've been learning new stuff all the time. And yet something new comes out in the marketing world every day. And you and I talk about it on this show, and we're learning together. You can never be arrogant enough to assume that you know everything. And I guess there's a bit of a balance to be struck here, because there are people of our age who have this attitude, well, you can't teach me anything else. I've been around for so long, I know it all, and I'm, you know, much better than all these young whippersnappers. But that's rubbish, because you do have to keep learning. You do have to keep adapting. And I think it is the people who are older who keep adapting and allow the wisdom of their age to overlap with that constant learning. They can be a formidable force. At the other end of the spectrum, the younger age, yes, a lot of people, the younger people, will immediately be able to pick up new technology and use it really well. But they haven't got those many, many years of life experience, which will give them a more rounded view. And there are young people who admit that, and they are happy to work with older people to create a better product or a better marketing campaign. But just as there are some older people who are, you know, folding their arms and saying, that's it, I, you know, you can't teach me anything, there are going to be younger people who say, no, older people are past it, we're the future, and you can't teach us anything because we know technology inside out. And it's the two of those extremes, that the young age and the old age, those people who refuse to acknowledge that by combining young developing experience with older experience, that you can get a better result by combining the two together. And I think it's those ones who doggedly refuse to acknowledge that, that ultimately aren't going to be as successful as perhaps they think they are.
Yeah, no, I love the idea of the formidable team. You know, if you're an enlightened MD, CEO, or even just an entrepreneur, but surround yourself with the external partners. If you can mix the you know, the generations and the capabilities, it would be a formidable team. So a big thank you to both Nick Morgan and John Ashwell. This has been really helpful for us to do that deep dive and our reflection. I hope that viewers and listeners, you've enjoyed also our reflection on that. But as we said many a time before, none of this would be possible without the vision and hard work of pioneers of the distant and recent past. Let's move on to our next segment, This Week in History.
In 1953, the first 3D motion picture produced and released by a major company, Man in the Dark, opened at the Globe Theatre in New York City, starring Edmund O'Brien. The next 3D feature, The House of Wax, was the first from a major company in colour and opened only 2 days later at the Paramount Theatre in New York City.
Well, talk about competition. In 1970, Paul McCartney announces he will no longer be working with the group. Legal disputes ensued, and the dissolution was not formalized until 29 December 1974.
In 1973, Marty Cooper, an engineer at Motorola, rang his counterpart at rival firm Bell Laboratories to triumphantly tell him he was calling from a personal handheld portable cell phone.
Right. In 1979, the movie Mad Max, starring Mel Gibson, is released. It was filmed on a budget of $400,000 Australian dollars and earned more than $100 million worldwide in gross revenue, setting a Guinness record for the most profitable film. I didn't know that.
Neither did I.
I
but
remember,
that goes to show, doesn't it? Is it a low budget, but a great film?
It is. It is. I remember it was advertised in France, and the whole PR was around not for children, you know, like adult only, that kind of things. It was very, really quite gripping. And of course, I wanted to see it even more, although I was only age 10 at the time. You are really the font of knowledge when it comes to music. So your reaction on 1970 announcement from Paul McCartney?
It's incredible that it's so long ago. Again, we've already said today how time passes, you know, and a lot of the groups that I grew up with and love and still love today were 80s bands. And yet we're talking here about one of the most famous bands in the history of music, the Beatles, breaking up over 50 years ago. I mean, that is staggering that their legacy has lasted for this long. And they are still just as popular now as they were then. I've always struggled a bit because I've never really been a Beatles fan. And I know that a lot of people listening to this or watching this will be now throwing stones at me or even throwing Rolling Stones at me. But I just never really got the Beatles. They were catchy. Some of the songs are obviously melodic choruses, et cetera, but I just never really got into them. I just find them quite bland for some reason, but I will still always recognize the unbelievably huge impact they had on the music business and on many people's lives, and you can't take that away.
Oh, completely. And so I was trying to remember, and I think I've got the year right, where 1969 was the last recording, the infamous, you know, with the infamous rooftop concert where the police stopped the Beatles from playing. I mean, you wouldn't do that now if it was like a huge band like the Rolling Stones or another. So 69, they recall the last album. The album is released that year when McCartney goes, well, I've got my own ideas. I'm going to do my own stuff. And to your point though about their legacy, I'm right in thinking it's just a handful of albums. I mean, they didn't create a lot of work. I mean, the work is obviously important, but it's not a huge legacy as a group, I would say.
No, that's right. It was a very, I mean, you're not talking about the output of a group like U2, who've had, I'd have to count 20 albums maybe over the course of 40 years. This was encapsulated within a very short period of time, and yet the legacy has been absolutely huge.
Maybe, is there something about in there about scarcity? Maybe we shall see.
Possibly. I mean, maybe that's why people get so excited if they manage to uncover a lost recording that somebody's found in a vault somewhere.
Before I move on to the 3D motion picture, which shocked me, I didn't realize it was that long ago, 1973. So I think I own my first personal mobile phone because before it was work. I mean, the only one that could afford mobile phones was the corporates, really. So my very first personal mobile phone was in the mid 90s, I'm sure of it. So 1973. And the how cheeky and the audacity of somebody ringing a competitor to say, we did it before you. So essentially, we invented a personal handheld portable cell phone before you, the famous Bell Lab. And Marty Cooper was interviewed in 2023 to reminisce about, you know, the anniversary of that. And they were asked, so what did they say? And they said nothing and put the phone down.
I've always, the whole 3D thing is really strange, isn't it? I mean, it's never really taken off anywhere, has it? I'm sure that we bought a 3D TV
right
a while back, And yes, we got a few Blu-rays which were 3D, and we had the glasses and we watched them in 3D. But then they just phased them out, didn't they? They stopped releasing 3D films in the cinema. They stopped putting them out onto DVD and Blu-ray. And when our television packed in, we just bought a normal one. It isn't 3D. So we do still have some 3D Blu-rays, but of course the good thing is that in within the package they also have the normal 2D version as well. So if we ever watch the film again, we watch that. But 3D you would expect because we live and breathe and you know our vision is 3D, and yet the film equivalent has never really taken off. It's always been a bit of a gimmick.
Yeah, I mean, I had a 3D TV too. I mean, you could put anything 3D. I would say watching a football match in 3D was good fun, but I used to get a headache. You know, I just, I mean, so we, I mean, Avatar was probably the best 3D movie we went to see at the theater. But the very, very first 3D movie that I saw at home on TV was the Creature of the Black Lagoon, or From the Black Lagoon. We had to get the red and blue. Rubbish, you know, kind of cardboard glasses from the news agent. It was like some major PR thing for a particular TV channel on in France. And I remember, as a child, of course, I thought it was amazing. But my parents absolutely hated the whole 3D thing. You know, it just wasn't particularly convincing. Interestingly, Jaws 3D was a big thing, and we may make a link with that for film marketing. But you know, it's fascinating to have that segment as part of the show because. You know, we talk about visual communication, we talk about technology and music and legacy and so on. It's very important to have a sense of history because I give you a good sense of direction and conversation we have about AI, where people, you know, could be a little surprised or perplexed. But actually, if people were to just understand that it arcs back to the early form of computer just after the Second World War, you know, it's not a big surprise. I mean, it's impressive. But everything has a understandable origin, and that's why I like this segment of the show.
Absolutely right.
All right, let's move on back into the present, which I probably want to be one of the most fascinating segment that we've done for marketing, tech, and apps, where we may, for the first time, disagree a little just after this. So in this part of the show, we select two apps, technologies, and solutions that can make life easier as a content creator. So what is your selection?
I'm going to be talking this week about Adobe Creative Cloud, Pascal. Now, this is interesting because on the show, since we started, I've probably argued about this particular point a few times. Now, if you buy the Adobe Creative Cloud suite, it's going to cost you about 50 quid a month, which is obviously 600 odd quid a year. So very expensive, actually. But the software is good, and you get Photoshop, you get Premiere Pro, the video editor, you get After Effects, which gives you the ability to do special effects. There's or Audition, which is an audio editor, and all sorts of other things as well. And every year for about the last 3 years, I've played this little trick, which I learned from somebody else, that if you go into the Adobe Creative Cloud website and cancel your subscription in the lead up to the end of the year, they usually give you a really good offer to get you to stay. And for the last 3 or 4 years, I have managed to renew my entire Adobe Creative Cloud package for about 25 quid, which is a lot more palatable for a small business like me than 600 quid a year. So this year, however, in the run-up to the anniversary and the renewal date, they haven't been offering that generous renewal package. It's sorry, you can upgrade to the full amount, 60 quid a 60 quid 50 quid a month, 600 quid a year, or you can just take Premiere Pro for 18 quid, or you can just take Photoshop for 18 quid, or you can just take After Effects. Now, I did think that if I left it right until the last day, that they would pop up with this offer again, but they didn't. So, as this was going on, I'd been planning. I'm not prepared to pay £600 a year, because I don't really use After Effects that often, once or twice in a year for my videos. Okay, we use Adobe Audition to do the podcast audio version of Two Geeks and a Marketing Podcast, but Audacity, which we're recording this episode on, is easy to use. So it made me think, if I can use Audacity just as easily as Adobe Audition, can I replace the Adobe Creative Cloud with other apps? And of course, the answer is yes. And most of these are actually free. So, and the first one is the most astonishing. To replace Photoshop, all you need to do is go onto a web-based app. It's a browser-based app. It's called Photopea. And Pascal, it is the absolute clone of Photoshop. Not only does it open Photoshop files, the interface and the menu structure is absolutely identical. And in fact, it's so identical, I don't know how Photopea get away with it. But Photopea is completely free. And yes, there's adverts appear in the top right corner. And you can pay a small fee to get to eliminate those if you want to. But I just cannot see why I would use and pay for Photoshop now that I've got access to Photopea. Already said, the Adobe Audition, which is the audio thing, I will be able to create the audio podcast version of Two Geeks each week just as easily in Audacity as I have been able to do in Adobe Audition. And in fact, I used to do the Marketing and Finance podcast, my own podcast, on Audacity. So that's not a problem at all, which leaves us with Premiere Pro and After Effects. Now, my big problem is that I've been using Premiere Pro for 4 years now for Rog Vlogs, and I do know how to use Premiere Pro, and I know where the menus are, and I can use it really quickly. And it is an infuriating program sometimes because it often crashes very often, and Trisha will confirm that you will often hear me screaming blue language like you've never heard before when Premiere Pro pulls off one of its crashes in the middle of an edit. And I have found DaVinci Resolve, which is offered by a company called Blackmagic Design. Now, we've mentioned Blackmagic Design on the podcast recently because they've been offering a camera app for Apple, which is really good and much better than the Apple app. And a lot of people say, why can Blackmagic offer this app for free? And the reason is that because they want you to buy their hardware. Now, Blackmagic Design actually create proper solid state tech. So you can buy these huge editing keyboards with wheels and dials and everything, you know, like mixing desk style stuff. So they're giving away this program called DaVinci Resolve, which is effectively a combination of Premiere Pro and After Effects, and it's even got elements of Audition in it for free, because they know that people will eventually buy their very expensive tech. And if you do buy their very expensive tech, which also includes an 8K camera, if you want to go up to 8K, then you get DaVinci Resolve thrown in for free. Now, DaVinci Resolve, I've been playing with it over the last few weeks, and it is absolutely astonishing. It is so much better than Premiere Pro. And one good thing about it is it doesn't seem to crash yet. So I've been massively impressed with it. Now, there is a paid version of DaVinci Resolve, which gives you a few extra features, and it's a one-off payment. They guarantee that once you've paid it, you'll never have to pay it again, whereas with Adobe, you're paying them year on year on year on year. So this is the conclusion that I've come to. I've dropped the Adobe Creative Cloud, so I'm going to be using Photopea now on instead of Photoshop. I'm going to be using Audacity now on instead of Audition. I'm going to be using DaVinci Resolve instead of After Effects. But what I have done is I've retained the Premiere Pro subscription from Adobe for another year. So that's gone down to £18. So I've saved myself £50 down to £18 from what I would be paying. And I've given myself a year to wean myself off Premiere Pro completely so that I can use DaVinci Resolve as fast as I can use Premiere Pro. And by this time next year, I'm sorry, Adobe, but you're out of here.
Yeah, and listen, thank you for doing all the research, because our viewers and listeners be making or thinking, well, maybe this is what I've been waiting for. You know, the only one that I've heard, you know, mention this Adobe Creative Cloud, which I think their pricing is off, because if you're an agency, I get it. You know, literally, because you can actually factor this into your invoicing when you do project for clients. But when you are a content creator and this is part of your marketing kind of activities, it's too high. And I mean, I don't know any other platforms that would go there. So yeah, well done you, and looking forward to perhaps we can ask you in 6 months' time, you know, how you're getting on with the alternative solution. So we prepare the show independently. We don't really kind of converse and share. So it's pure random that I chose to praise Adobe for something today. They have released reasonably newish free products. I'm talking about Adobe as a brand, as opposed to the Creative Cloud element. So the first one that really impressed me, we got to thank a friend of the show, Ian Anderson Gray, where under the Adobe Express sub-brand, they have released a completely free social media scheduler. So you free to have an Adobe Express account. Some of you have done this already, perhaps as a kind of to some on occasion move away from Canva. So what this is a extremely user-friendly and very visual scheduler, because they all exist out there from Buffer to Hootsuite to Social Cal and all those. But again, you're almost into the territory of semi-pro agency. And this one is very much designed for independent content creators and marketers. The second product, which is even more impressive. So you may remember a few months ago, you and I announced that Adobe was entering the podcast arena. And they did so by offering a audio cleaning type product. So you could upload an audio that was particularly noisy or was particularly clear, and the result would be an AI kind of cleaning up, and it was always very, very impressive. Now, since about 2-3 weeks ago now, they have released the free podcast recording and editing solution. So the hyperlink is on the show notes, podcast.adobe.com/studio. I was on the beta or the IP list, whatever you want to call it, Roger. So I got the alert. I went in and had a play, and very impressive. It's almost, if you know, the best of Descript, where your podcast is transcribed, and then you can work on the transcript to do the editing. So you can remove sections, you can remove the ums and ahs, you can add music, you can move things around. So you could literally, if you wanted to, using a drag and drop, move a segment at the top and change things around to surprise your audience. So the editing is, again, very much like the scheduler, very visual. You don't have to understand the kind of linear, non-linear suite that you and I would use. So again, is it possible for people to switch to a different podcast editing solution? If you are thinking about podcasting for the first time, this could be a very, very strong ally. So today was more, yeah, Adobe, thank you very much for allowing people to access free products so they can learn and upskill themselves, perhaps then to move on to a different platform. But I have to say, not only is the podcast editing and recording very good, but the team, because I had a couple of questions, are super responsive as well via email. So have a go, everyone, and let us know what you think.
I wonder whether these things that you've talked about here are actually done by a different part of Adobe to the others. Because you're absolutely right, the pricing of Adobe Creative Cloud is just ridiculous, especially for small businesses like you and I. Interestingly enough, one of the features within DaVinci Resolve is this audio cleanup feature, and I've just been messing around with this, and it's utterly remarkable. I mean, I've got a piece of video that I took stood in the middle of a bar, with music playing in the background and noise of people's conversations. And it absolutely rubs out all that background noise completely. And your voice sounds as if you were speaking in a studio, which is not dissimilar to what this podcast thing that Adobe's doing. So it just goes to show the amazing technology that we have these days when it comes to things like video and audio. So yeah, I'm not rubbishing Adobe's products per se, apart from the fact that Premiere Pro does crash far too often. But I think their pricing structure is nuts, and they need to revisit that for people like us.
Super. Everyone, we've reached the final segment of our show, Film Marketing, just after this. Okay, Roger, so for this episode, you chose the film An Officer and a Gentleman, released in 1982. Let's watch a trailer.
I joined the Navy.
You joined the Navy.
What's so funny?
You, man.
Jets. Wanna fly jets?
What a family, my dream!
Grace, look at yourself. Officers don't have tattoos.
What's your name, boy?
Mayo. Zach Mayo, sir.
Go, go, come on, baby.
You got a girl, Mayo, to watch?
No, I ain't looking for one either.
What are you looking for?
I'll tell you something about the local girls who come across the Sound on the ferry every weekend. Just one thing in mind, and that's to marry themselves a naval aviator.
I heard about these girls. They're looking for a husband.
Tell me.
I will use every means necessary, fair and unfair. Oh! Oh! Trip you up. Expose your weaknesses as a potential aviator and as a human being. I expect to lose half of you before I'm finished.
So get out of here. I think it'd be a guess.
Just how far would you go to get back? Would you let yourself get pregnant?
Don't trick him or try to trap him.
So, Zach, what do you do with a girl when you're through with her?
I see you've had some training, man. Eh? In every class, there's always one joker who thinks that he's smarter than me.
What kind of a human being are you?
You better lock it up, boy.
I'm trying to be nice to you. I'm trying to be your friend, Zach.
Well, then be a friend. Get out of here.
Now, why would a slick little hustler like you want to sign up for this kind of abuse anyway?
I want to fly jets, sir.
My grandmama wants to fly jets.
No, man, you ain't nothing special. And if you ask me, you ain't got no chance of being no officer.
I ain't gonna quit.
You're out.
Don't you do it. Don't. I got nowhere else to go.
Richard Gere, Deborah Winger. An Officer and a Gentleman. Coming soon from Paramount Pictures.
That is such a good old school trailer, isn't it? With a voiceover towards the end as well. And you can't beat it when you get the
voiceovers. Yeah, they have to go back to their style, Roger, you know? Yeah. Do you remember, I mean, I first saw this on TV, therefore maybe in the mid to late 80s. And I was so captivated, which suggests to me, therefore, that the story work, the acting work, this kind of, you know, fly on the wall in a world that at the time I didn't really understand, you know, the Navy, you know, the training for the pilots and so on. This is obviously a few years before Top Gun, if memory serves, which has a very, very different style and palette. But I remember really, really rooting for the character played by Richard Gere and wanting him to do well because I understood, you know, that he didn't have the best of upbringing, clearly. I felt that the character played by Deborah Winger was such a strong female character. That was a bit of an eye-opener to me as well, because previous movies had given the female role more of a, you know, kind of second, you know, companion to the hero journey, that kind of thing. So I would say that I've seen this movie maybe only two or three times, but I remember everything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember wanting to go and see it because of that trailer, believe it or not. This is one of the first few films that I can genuinely remember. It was the trailer that made me want to go and see it. And it was also the first film I ever went to see with probably my first serious girlfriend. And she was really keen to see it as well. And when we went to see it, I think she was quite shocked as we were watching it at the levels of profanity in the film. There's quite a lot of swearing going on, especially in the chanting that the the troops do as they're running around the base. But actually, it's quite an explicit film. There's a really quite explicit sex scene in the middle of this film. And I remember she wanted to leave. And I'm sitting there, no, this is a bloody good film. I want to stay. So we did stay in the end. And I think in the end, she did enjoy it, especially that ending. But yeah, no, I've seen this film many, 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 many times. It is one of those films that I just think is timeless. It is over 40 years old, but I think maybe because it's set on an army base and it doesn't depend upon even the technology of the day. So the fact that they haven't got mobile phones, it doesn't matter. It's a period piece and it's timeless for that reason. But I do think that it's all about the relationships, as you've said. You're absolutely right. Deborah Winger's character, Paula, is so strong. But it's a sort of love story between Zach and Paula, and also a love story between Sid and Lynette. And of course, the two love stories go in completely different directions. But it's also this conflict story as well, a conflict between Zach and the drill instructor, played by Louis Gossett Jr. And that is just remarkable. Remarkable filmmaking, remarkable dialogue, remarkable acting, and every scene that they are in is just lights up the screen. It's intense, it's deep, but you like both of the characters, and it's the transformation that Gossett Jr. gets out of Zach Mayo's character as the film progresses is astonishing.
And he plays the role of the mentor in the screenwriting parlance, but not the mentor that we've seen necessarily before. You know, is not the Obi-Wan Kenobi, kind-hearted kind of wizard. And is really going through the transformation painfully. I remember some of the training scenes, but also the one that even as a young person broke my heart when the character is being punished for a transgression of sort, and he's doing a day full of press ups and push ups and sit ups and so on, and basically we got the students saying, just leave, just go away, and literally said, but I've got nowhere else to go. This is all I've got. Broke my heart because it felt so sincere. And actually, when you learn that this is based on a book where somebody had a dream to be a pilot and that was taken away from him because of medical condition, we've all been there, perhaps as children, where we had a dream job or profession or career and it doesn't quite go the way you want it. That shock of having to change your plans is always so. Yeah, that movie just stayed with me forever.
And it is about people finding themselves and developing their personalities and their attitudes through their experiences. And if you think about it, this takes place within a 13-week period where these Navy recruits are at this base for 13 weeks of pure torture to get them to see whether they're fit to be officers. And yet so much happens within that 13-week period, which will obviously set them up for the rest of their lives. It's really quite remarkable. And I guess that we have to talk about, before we start talking about the production and the marketing and that sort of thing, the very final scene, a lot of people sort of see this scene as being quite cheesy. And a little bit cliched, and it doesn't give anything away to say that the end of the film, you've got Paula and Zach, who you think of aren't going to stay together, but there she is in the factory. The music starts playing. It's the instrumental version of Up Where We Belong. It's got this great sort of bam, 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 bam playing in the background. He walks into the factory with his crisp white Navy uniform on. And of course, he creeps up behind her and obviously whispers something into her ear, which we don't know. Will you marry me? Or something like that. And she turns around and they have a hug and a kiss, and all the rest of the people in the factory start applauding, and he picks her up and carries her off out of the door whilst this music is reaching its crescendo. And apparently when Gear read this in the script, he thought, well, this is awful, it's just as cliche as hell, I don't even think we should film it. And I know a lot of people say that it's cheesy, but every single time I watch this film, and it's going to happen now, just me explaining it, I just tear up because it is such a powerful ending. It isn't cliched at all. The way they do it, the way they film it, the way they layer the music and the way it builds is just utterly remarkable. And I guess you all sit there thinking as well, Richard Gere is rescuing Deborah Winger from her life working in a factory, and living in a sort of small American town. But you actually really do have to ask yourself, who actually is rescuing who at the end of that film? And I think that's the key thing.
For me, that ending is not, well, I never felt it was cheesy, ever. I think it's either people have been cynical throughout the entire movie, because that ending is the payoff. Is we talk about the Rick Gossett Jr., the mentor, and a few others, there to go through the what we call the metamorphosis in, again, screenwriting lingo. And that's what's happened. He's a transformed individual, and so is she in the process, and they find and save each other from essentially again the life that could hold them back. So no, and I think the music, which is part of the marketing pack, you could argue, and the song, when you hear it sang by Joe Cocker, and then it's going to escape
Jennifer
me now.
warns.
Thank you very much. If it's on a radio, I put it up. I put it on Volume 11, if people know what that means. So, to give you a bit of a segue to the marketing, because doing the research, I want to give you an audience context of what 1982 was. I mean, Roger and I will tell you that the 80s was the best decade ever, when it comes to movies, entertainment, computing, and so on. But this movie was up against a lot of very, very good films, and ultimately audiences at the time only had so much time, only so much money to go to the theater. But 1982, Roger, was the year of Firefox with Clint Eastwood, if you remember that. We
Wow,
had The
yes.
Dark Crystal. Can you imagine? You had Gandhi, you had Tron, you had Rocky III, Eye of the Tiger, you had Stallone, oddly, First Blood, you had Poltergeist, you had E.T., Blade Runner. Can you imagine all those movies demanding your attention? And just for you as a special treat, they also had Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So you've got all that going on. And all those movies, if you pay attention to the list, are this fiction work, right? And here's a movie that is really the tale that happened to somebody else, the author. Okay, it's been dramatized. So how do you get an audience to go and see a movie that is not going to be necessarily entertaining to the degree of the one that I've just listed for you, but it's going to be just as enthralling?
It's really strange, isn't it? Just to finish the girlfriend story as well, I remember going to see three films in over 3 weeks. Officer and a Gentleman was the first one. The second week we went to the cinema was to see Airplane 2. So that was another film that came out that year. And the third week was E.T. So those were the three. We probably broke up and split up after those 3 weeks. It wasn't a very long relationship, but it's always stuck in my head. But yeah, it's strange, isn't it? This was the film that I remember the most from 1982, even though it was surrounded by films like you've already mentioned, it was Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, and because it's such a long time ago, it's hard to find anything that was happening from a marketing point of view. So perhaps it just was the strength of that trailer and the fact that that trailer revealed that the film was sort of a real life thing as opposed to fantasy. So here you've got a real film about real people developing emotions in an era when we were surrounded by fantasy films like Star Trek, fantasy films like E.T., and even jokey comedies like Airplane 2. Here's something that was just grounded in reality, and perhaps that was what the attraction was at the time. But a little bit of background, directed by Taylor Hackford, written by Douglas Day Stewart, obviously Richard Gere, Deborah Winger, David Keith, Lisa Blount, Louis Gossett Jr., we've already mentioned, other people that you'll recognise as well in the film that you'll have seen. I often spot Della Serrer in films these days. And even the girl who played Casey Seagrave, you see her pop up in films from time to time. And Louis Gossett Jr. himself actually appeared in a film with Dennis Quaid, maybe. Was it Dennis Quaid? Where he was an alien. It was called
Enemy Mine. Enemy Mine.
Or Enemy Mine.
Enemy Mine, yeah.
And it was completely rubber mask, but it was Louis Gossett Jr. And it was another almost Oscar-winning performance. Talking of which, 1993 Best Supporting Actor role for this film went to Louis Gossett Jr. And, of course, the Best Oscar for Best Original Song for Up Where We Belong. A couple of things I picked up from the production notes is that Taylor Hackford purposefully kept Louis Gossett Jr. away from the rest of the cast. It was almost like a method acting thing, was it? He was only there during the take, so they never got to know him as an individual. So he was genuinely this sort of scary individual. What I did think was interesting is that there was a real life gunnery sergeant, a guy called R. Lee Ermey, who came in to train Louis Gossett Jr. how to be a drill instructor. And this guy was a real drill instructor in real life. They did toy with the idea of getting him to play Foley initially, but in the end they wanted Louis Gossett Jr. to do it. But this R. Lee Ermey guy was training Gossett Jr. how to be a drill instructor. And Lee Ermey went on to be the drill instructor in Full Metal Jacket,
indeed,
which came out in 1987. And I always remember watching Full Metal Jacket, and there's this scene where he comes in and he's doing the shouting thing, just like Louis Gossett Jr. did in Officer and a Gentleman. And he says, "The only thing that come out of Oklahoma are steers and queers." And I thought, "Hey, you've nicked that line from Officer and a Gentleman. That's what Sergeant Foley said in Officer and a Gentleman." But ironically, of course, the steers and queers line came from Lee Ermey training Gossett Jr. to be a drill instructor for that film. So he did originate that phrase, but of course it was delivered by Louis Gossett Jr. I always love that little bit of trivia there. And as I said before, alluding to the girlfriend, there was a lot of foul language in this film, and a particularly erotic sex scene in the middle of it as well. And in the UK particularly, we were on the verge of introducing a new series of classifications. Up until 1982, you would have an A film, which was for you had to have your parent with you. You had a double A, which was for age 14 and over, and then after double A there was an X, and that was with people for 18 and over. And it's the fact that the classification board at the time wanted to give Officer and a Gentleman an X certificate because of that sex scene, but then they brought in the new classifications just around the time of the film's release. And it then fitted into the new 15 category. So people under the 14 missed out a little bit, but at least they then didn't have to wait until the age of 18 to see it. And again, I thought that was quite a nice, interesting little thing. But obviously for the TV versions, they edited out all that bad language, and the sex scene was fairly much excised from the film as it was. Looking at the marketing, Pascal, again, such a long time ago, we've already discussed the trailer. Phenomenally good, gives you all the bits you need. The voiceover draws you into it. I just think it sums up the emotion of the film, and it's about real people. And I think that's why it stood out for me. The poster, again, nice and simple. You've got that image of Deborah Winger and Richard Gere embracing in the background with the sun, but then you've got almost at the forefront of the image, you've got him in his white Navy uniform, and then the image of them running along the beach with Sergeant Foley being beasted by the drill instructor. Again, the more I talk about this with you now, the more I'm thinking that the reason this film stood out was it was a real thing as opposed to a fantasy. And maybe looking back now, 1982 was the year of the fantasy, Star Trek, E.T., etc. this was grounded in reality. And maybe that's why the marketing, simple as it was, actually worked.
I want to spend a bit longer, if you'll allow me, on the poster, because again, it feels like, and pun intended, it was imprinted into my mind, because that design and the choice of colors. You've got him in white, which is a transformational bit. You've got the drilling with they're all in black. You've got a kind of sunset lit sepia looking embrace and so on. And you know, post design, people don't wing it. You know, nothing's done by chance. There's been a careful consideration, and it feels to me almost like a montage of negative films that then gone to print, and there's some echo in there of documentaries of you know, real life articles in hard hitting magazine like the Time and whatever. So back to your point about non-fiction work, I think this poster is very, very strong because they don't afraid to use the white space quite a bit, the title and so on. But the montage takes me back to reportage of war, you know, events in Vietnam and that kind of things. And it's got that grainy effect and so on. So again, I have admiration for any form of graphic design typically, but the film posters in particular, where if you compare that to the effort of today, which is where there's a formula that seems to be applied all the time, and therefore films are not given as strong an identity as they used to in the 80s. But also you must remember that movies were advertised heavily in newspapers back in the days. So that poster, or even a smaller version in just black and white, because that's how newspapers would have been printed then, would have just popped at, you know, on a page compared to all the others were a lot busier, a lot darker, not use of white space as much. So, and like I said, I mean, this poster, I know it by heart, both because of simplicity, but this visual impact.
And I wasn't able to find any reference to this at all. So this might be my memory cheating me, but I also think the music from the film must have played quite a big part in the marketing of it. At the time, Love Live Does Up, Where We Belong was played a lot on the radio. I'm sure it was played on TV shows like Multicolored Swap Shop and the equivalent Saturday morning shows for children. And of course, the video for that song had a montage of images from the film. So you were hearing the song, but seeing bits of the film. The soundtrack to the movie was also quite contemporary. There's a song by ZZ Top in there called Tush, which was a big hit at the time, which is it is played over the fight scene early on in the film where they're coming out of the bar and Mayo surprises them all by being a martial artist and he knocks over the local thugs. There's also a Dire Straits song played almost in its entirety in the scene set in TJ's bar. It's called Tunnel of Love, which ironically is the song Tunnel of Love is about Newcastle and South Shields and all of that. But that's a bit of a tangent. And ironically, that Dire Straits song, it's called Tunnel of Love, and it comes from an album called Making Movies, which I always thought was actually quite a nice link. But I remember at the time, particularly the fact they'd used this Dire Straits song. And Dire Straits, the group, were huge in the early 80s. You know, they were a guitar band amongst, you know, the emerging synth pop movement at the time, so they really stood out as a sort of bit of a old-fashioned sound, but they were huge at the time and they were having major tours all over the world. And I think, and I'm convinced that I saw interviews with Mark Knopfler, and that was interspersed with video from this film, especially the
Cross.
scene where the song's playing. So whilst we've not been able to find as much marketing collateral online because this film is 40 odd years old, there's still the memories of the marketing in my head. So that proves that it must have been really quite special.
Oh, for sure. You know, poster trailers, lobby cards, music track. I mean, they couldn't have released them on Spotify like they do nowadays, but it would
No,
be
no.
part of the memory. Listen, I want to find a way, and this is going to be, it's going to come across rather clumsy, but I want to find a way to dedicate this recording of the film marketing and of the gentleman to the memory and the legacy of Louis Gossett Jr. You contacted me a few weeks ago saying I'd like to do this film, and I jumped with joy because you always do the selection. And within a week of you making that decision, sadly, Louis Gossett Jr. Passed on. And I mean, that was a shock because certainly he's been acting theatre first, then movie and TV for a very, very long time. But I feel like we've grown up with him, certainly from the 70s and 80s. People all over the internet on Facebook saying, well, without Iron Eagle, you know, I wouldn't be where I am today. And you mentioned Enemy Mine and Tall Soldiers. We mentioned Joe's Story, The Principal. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And even just very recently, he was part of the remake of The Color Purple. So I'd like to just acknowledge that and, in some way, rather clumsily, I would argue, thank him for his hard work and legacy. But also saying that without his contribution in this character, I don't think this movie would be a point of conversation 40 odd years later.
No, absolutely not. No, that's nice, and I think it's good for us to acknowledge Louis Gossett Jr., sad loss to the acting industry and a sad loss to filmmaking.
This is the end of episode 116 of Two Geeks and Martin podcast. Thank you again, Roger, for being an amazing co-host and for all the research. For all of you as the listeners, please do tell others to subscribe if you haven't done so. Leave your comment and suggestion, particularly for film marketing, in the usual places. Until next time, go out there and make sure your marketing is done right. I was Pascal Pintoni, and it was Roger Edwards.